And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast from Los Angeles, where all of us are still trying to digest exactly what happened yesterday and the enormity of the loss in the helicopter crash that killed Kobe Bryant, his daughter Gigi, and seven other people. And I don't know. I spent last night because I just didn't know what else to do. I just started watching old Kobe games because I knew that ESPN would ask me to at some point write about Kobe, the basketball player. So I just went on YouTube and watched some Kobe playoff games. This is not even a Kobe story anymore. It's a multifamily tragedy, and the presence of the young girls really just took it to another. I just didn't know how to react. I still don't know how to react. And to help talk us all through it, we have someone who covered Kobe for a long time, Ramona Shelburne, and another person who covered Kobe for a long time, Tui Angelinos now as well, Rachel Nichols. How are you guys?
I mean, Zach, when they said Gianna was on the plane, that's what broke me. Because the tragedy of Kobe and losing him and everything we know he was still yet to do is one thing. And then you look back at everything he accomplished, which was probably eight people's lifetimes crammed into the 41-year lifetime. But Gigi, I mean, she was 13. No, there was another young girl on the helicopter, and the idea that all of that, that whole big story that was waiting to be told from her, from the other young woman on the plane, it's just unimaginable.
Well, you know, I was talking to Ken Field, our producer for SportsCenter yesterday. We went out to the Mamba Academy in Thousand Oaks, and it was just a line of Laker fans, but especially young teenage girls who had played with Gigi and the other teammates who were on board that helicopter who died in the crash. And it was just like so quiet and so sad. And Kenny and I, you know, we just started talking like parents, right? Like, I have a young son. Rachel, I know you're a parent. Zach, you're a parent. And it's like, that's the part I just wanted to run home and hug my son. Because, like, Kobe gave us his greatness. He gave it to us. We have that. We have movies and we have games. You can watch YouTube. I went back and read all the emails we exchanged over the years and the text messages and the interviews we did and stories we'd all written. Like, his death is a tragedy, but we don't know what Gigi would have been. We don't know what the other young women on that helicopter would have been. Like, she might have been the greatest basketball player of women's basketball history. Like, Candace Parker and I were talking last night. And she met Gigi and Kobe, right? They came to Sparks games, and Kobe was so proud of her. Like, he would always tell me about how good Gigi was. She was going to be in the league. She was going to UConn. And Candace was like, man, she was just down there working out with me and Layla. And it's like, we don't know what those young women would have become. We don't know what greatness they had to offer. And, like, that's the part of this that, like, I know what I can say about Kobe because I knew him and he let us know him. I don't know what to say about the young women who died.
In a way, it's in a way, this is a tragedy, like a lot of tragedies. Except this one hits our world, and so we think about it more. But I was watching just before the jump today. I was watching the video of the husband of Christina Maurer, I think her name was. Yeah. And I just don't even know how you have a conversation, let alone have a TV person from the Today Show call you on the phone. So you know what's going through your mind and give an articulate answer. And he said, I'm scared. I'm scared for what happens to me now and what happens to my family. And I just don't know. Like, this is things like this happen a lot, and we're focusing on this one because Kobe's in our world. But that interview is like, I had the same reaction as you, Ramona. Like, I had my flight to come out here and do what I thought was a nice, normal week of shows on the jump. We're going to talk about the Pistons or something. Was 15 minutes into takeoff.
Oh, wow.
And I got this email from the ESPN news desk, which I know you were on. I don't know if you were on, Rachel, saying TMZ has a report that Kobe Bryant has died in a helicopter crash. And I'm just sitting there like, what? And I spent the next 5 hours just looking at my screen. I don't know what happened. I just looked at Twitter. When the Wi-Fi was working, I looked at Twitter. and these updates come in and it's bad information and good information, but I had the same reaction as you. I wanted to just turn around and go hug my daughter. That's all I wanted. It's what I want to do now. I just want to go home and I don't want to think about like Trey Young's pick and roll numbers for, I just want to go home and hug my daughter. And I don't know. I don't really know. This is like uncharted territory for all of us. I don't know how we're supposed to cover this. I don't know how we're supposed to talk about it. And this is the whole season, by the way. It's the whole season. It's the whole summer. It's the story of the whole, everything is going to be changed from now until I don't know when.
You know, guys, I was, reading old, transcripts from some of the last interviews that we had done, and Kobe was obsessed with Achilles. He was obsessed with this legend of the Greek warrior who was the greatest warrior of all time, who was given this choice by the gods to say, you can have a short life but be remembered forever, or you can have a long life of little consequence. And he was obsessed with that. When he tore his own Achilles, he just learned everything about that. And it was like, it was really eerie to me to read this again, to read that transcript in light of what happened, because I think he was already larger than life, but like the way he died, the time he died, how he died, like I just think he's Achilles now. I mean, like, he's short life, remembered forever. But the other side of Achilles is that to have the good, to have that that warrior, to be the greatest warrior of all time, there's also a profound sadness. Like, there's this battle where his best friend wears his armor and he's killed because the army thought they were killing Achilles, and that grief just killed him. I mean, that and Achilles always had to live with that. I don't know if that's the trade-off that we have with men like this, with legends like this. Like, I don't think it doesn't help me now, but I think to even process this, but I think we're sometimes that's what you turn to, like legends and myths and stories like this, where it's like this is how big and enormous it all feels for everybody, right? Like you said, it's the whole season now, it's the whole year, it's the rest of for a long time now. Like, you can't talk about Kobe without remembering where you were on when you found out how he died.
Trace McGrady was just on the jump and crying, like we all have been, and he said he remembered from being a teenager with Kobe.
Yeah.
Kobe telling him, I want to die young. I want to be a legend. Oh. And that kept ringing in his ears yesterday. And of course, as Tracy and I talked about, that changed, of course, once he had children. It's not like he was saying that recently.
Yeah.
That was the words of an 18 or 19-year-old Tracy McGrady. And at this age, at 40, 41, he wanted to live forever. He wanted to guide Gigi and his three other children into whatever they wanted to do and be. He wanted to help all the world's kids. I mean, it sounds like such a, you know, bad Coke commercial or something. I'd like to teach the world to sing. Well, but he focused on kids in his post-retirement. Children's books. The Mamba Academy was about training not just young men, but young women that he made such an effort with and such an emphasis on. And hearing T-Mac say that today, that the 18 or 19-year-old version of Kobe said, I want to die young. I want to be a legend. It's not what he, as a later adult, would have wanted, and obviously his family will be forever ripped apart by this. But he is a legend.
It's I was just texting back and forth with Mike Procopio, Sweet Chuck, who used to be an assistant coach with the Mavs and was broke into the NBA by being Kobe's sort of personal video guy and scout, and would send Kobe reports at all hours of the night because Kobe was
wanted
like
it.
That, and would make crazy requests of him at all hours of the night. And Mike and I were text just literally right now, and he said, you know, how unfair it all is, but he said something to your point, saying, I felt, you know, they've still been in touch. They still talk all the time. And he said, I felt like Kobe was becoming a human being after, now that his career was over, and now that he had stepped out of the NBA and was becoming a father. He said it was fun to see him sort of humanize a little bit and not be a legend and not be something that was, and Kobe participated in his own myth making, I think very intentionally. toward the end of his career, especially when he suddenly made this transformation, not just to the Black Mamba, which was I think he's talked about a reaction to the Colorado sex assault mm-hmm. case and taking on a new identity. And you can't talk about Kobe without talking about that. But I was just as struck late in his career by his sudden transformation into like foul-mouthed, cantankerous,
yeah.
soft as Charmin old man,
yeah.
calling his teammates soft and Charmin. And I thought that was like a very calculated,
oh, yeah.
like I'm the old head legend. I'm the one that I come from the era when, you know, I didn't play AAU. I was overseas, you know, rivals were rivals and you know, blah, blah. It was interesting to, I'm just rambling now because I have a million thoughts in my head, but it was just Mike saying to me for the first time in all the years I knew Kobe, I saw a regular human, a regular person.
Well, it's funny you say the word calculated, and it's true, and it's also something that people could take to mean that you're saying fake, because sometimes people who put on a front, right, calculate it. But for me, watching Kobe go through that another transformation wasn't about being fake. It was about him having purpose about who yeah. he wanted to be and him deciding at this stage of his career, I miss some of that stuff. That in being so hyper competitive, and yeah. I mean, he and T-Mac were super tight for the first few years of their NBA careers. Tracy was a year behind Kobe and used to call Kobe on the phone for advice mm-hmm. every week. He would stay at his house. But then once they were competing for scoring titles, they didn't speak for years. And I think Kobe realized later in the very end of his career and certainly the beginning of his retirement, and I don't think it, I know it because we talked about it, he missed out on some things because of his maniacal way he dealt with his teammates and some of the other people around him. And he wanted some of it.
Yeah.
And so he was calculated in that way of being like, I want to be this kind of person. And it wasn't inauthentic. It was just on purpose.
So watching those games last night, it struck me, and this is going to be in my column if my brain ever begins functioning again. It struck me just watching. I watched games from 2008, so the Powell era. Mm-hmm. I watched a couple Shaq era games against the Kings. It struck me that Kobe, this is an obvious observation, but he could have been any kind of player that he wanted. He was so talented. And so, like, if you gave him now a spread pick and roll offense, he could average 30 points and 9 assists a game and run 75 pick and rolls mm-hmm. a game. He was that mm-hmm. talented.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, and Robert Horry talked about this on The Jump today with you, Rachel, mm-hmm. even then, Kobe, his teammates a lot of times had problems with him because he wanted to shoot all the time. Or he wanted to shoot no times because he was throwing a temper tantrum about how people had told him to stop shooting all yeah. the time. And it just, you imagine him playing in a different system or with a different mindset, and you wonder what other kind of player he could have been. And because he could have done anything. He was that skilled. He could have been any kind of player you wanted. He was that skilled. But he decided for some reason, I have to be a scorer. Mm-hmm. I have to be the guy who takes all the tough mid-range jump shots. That has to be my mentality. And it rubbed some teammates the wrong way here and there. It rubbed some coaches the wrong way here and there. And you want to say it was sort of a you called it maniacal, sort of a misguided application of his maniacal mm-hmm. competitiveness. But then you wonder, like, was there any other way to apply it? Is it just his nature? And without that, you don't get the great Kobe Bryant player without the misguided Kobe Bryant player.
That's right.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, you know, he said after he tore his Achilles, he was sitting there, he was getting the cast on, and I think he knew that this was the beginning of the end. Like, he knew it. He felt like, okay. He was rational about these things, too. As much as he was, you know, he had this indomitable will, like, he was just gonna...
Do you think he was rational about it?
Oh, yeah.
It?
Yeah.
Because I remember...
No, he talked himself into that, and he did a whole documentary trying to prove that he would overcome all that. But he knew, and I know it because he acted different. He was already starting to line up the rest of his life. He had had a lot of conversations with Michael Jordan about post basketball and retirement. He saw what happened to Jordan in the Wizards, but he also saw what happened to Jordan after he retired. And there was this sort of aimlessness that I think Wright Thompson captured in that wonderful feature on Michael, you know, several years ago, of just looking for that next purpose in life. And Kobe flat out said to me back in 2016, he was like, I'll be damned if I'm going into the next stage of my life without a purpose. Mm-hmm. And Rachel, when you talk about, like, you know, his new purpose mm-hmm. as a father, mm-hmm. As a storyteller, as a, it sounds small to say content creator. Okay. But he had a lot to say. He had lived this extraordinary life.
Well, he spent his whole career shaping
yeah,
narratives.
That's right.
So then he became a professional.
I mean, I would like to say that I am a good writer, but man, that guy is the best writer of his own story. Like, you would get done with an interview and you're just like, shh. jeez.
Right. He just gave it all
yeah,
to you.
Yeah. I mean, all I got to do is not mess this up, right?
It is remarkable when you just think about the bare facts, right? Yeah. And we will sit here for, I was going to say days, weeks, months, years,
it's
trying
never,
to put
it's,
color.
It's never going to stop. There's the NBA is going to be, for us, of our generation, is going to be before this and after this.
Yes. So we will spend all of that time trying to give context to everything. But if you just go back to the barest of bare, the things that fit on one piece of paper, and you look at the titles, and you look at the scoring, and you look at the all-star appearances, and the impact he had in terms of all the players who you can trace a direct line of descendants to him, he had one of the greatest sports careers in history.
Yeah.
Not at basketball, not America, one of the greatest sports careers in the history of sports being played professionally around the world. And then 2 years later, from walking away, he wins an Oscar.
Yeah.
That juxtaposition to me is insane. Because that is the pinnacle of an entirely different profession. Some of our greatest actors, directors, writers have never won an Oscar. If you think about, you know, I'm not going to start naming people, but obviously there are people who we consider some of our best in that field who have never won an Oscar. And here he was after doing the best thing in one thing, came in and just like, oh, I'll do that
and,
too.
Rachel, you know what that is? The word that I keep coming back to today? Audacious.
That's so good. I've read that in your piece, which by the way, if you have not read Ramona's piece, I'm going to do a little plug here on ESPN.com or the app. It's so personal and really illuminating about who Kobe was. Okay, plug over. Keep going.
I mean, like, you know, he would call up J.K. Rowling. Like, he would call up Tim Cook. You call up Darren Aronofsky. Like, cold call him, you know? Like, and I think he did this to you once, Zach. We'll talk about that in a little bit. He would just call up people he admired. And he wouldn't just call them once. Like, first, I'm sure they were a little surprised. Like, okay, am I being pranked? Is this really Kobe? Like, come on, man. Like, it's like when the president calls. Like, you don't think that's really him. And then he would just want to talk. And then if you let him in a little bit, he would call and bug the shit out of people. Okay? Like, he would obsess over these people. And he thought that if he just talked to J.K. Rowling enough, he could learn to write stories like Harry Potter. That is an audacious thought, and yet he freaking did it. Like, he would call up John Williams, you know, the composer for all of his Dear Basketball, and he would just go get him to go, you know, to do the music for whatever he was doing. But he would ask him about the chord structure, and he would say, I want the chords in Dear Basketball to be like Moonlight Sonata, because that's the pain and the anger and the love and the passion in that is what I want to represent my basketball journey. He would say things like this, and like, honestly, when he would first say, you know, he at one point after he played his last game, he just referenced Walt Disney, like, casually.
Walt.
Okay. And I was like, as in Disney? Like you created this whole mythological universe over the last couple of years while you were playing basketball and all that, because you were inspired by Walt, like you're on a first name basis with him. I had to laugh.
I mean, honestly, if you told me that Kobe Bryant went into the cryo chamber and had a conversation with Walt's head, I would believe it. I'm saying I do not know, no disrespect to any dead persons. That is my point about Kobe Bryant is that, and that is part of what made yesterday so unbelievable because my Lord, nothing was going to take that man down. And then it's an echo of what we've been saying about David Stern for the last month. These are two men who I could say of anyone in the cast of characters of the NBA who were the most singular about never giving up and not stopping until they got what they wanted. And to lose both of them so close to each other and to see, I mean, we always, the expression that's way overused, Father Time is undefeated, death waits for us all, and it is to see them taken like that, it's staggering.
Well, audacity is in my draft of my column too, and it starts, you know, in high school when he would go to Sixers practices and challenge everyone to one-on-one. And when I had Jerry Stackhouse on my podcast in Vegas 2 summers ago, I texted Kobe and said, hey, I'm having Jerry Stackhouse on my podcast. I know, you know, there are conflicting accounts of how often you beat him one-on-one, which I asked him. And he said, ask him what happened when I was a junior in high school and I went to Sixers practice and I played him one-on-one. And if he tries to lie and say he beat me once, say this is the text. If he tries to lie,
yeah,
call Tom Thibodeau and call John Luke. He like gave me a list of witnesses who could confirm that Kobe beat Jerry Stackhouse at age 16 one-on-one every single time they played. He was like, dude, and he was, you know, he's not kidding. He's if he tries to lie, call him out. Do your research.
I mean, Rachel, I think we sat together at his last game.
We did.
And like, I was kind of nostalgic. Like, I remember, I just felt like the whole city saying goodbye to this guy that, you know, that for 20 years, he'd been this constant, like, probably the way New York felt about Jeter.
Sure.
They are very, very comparable.
Yeah.
In a few ways.
And Jeter had just retired, and so everybody was still, you know, like, oh, another two decades of this guy growing as from boy to man and then aging out and becoming an old man, and as basketball goes. And I felt like that second half, like I tend to be a very sentimental person. Like I count down the minutes. I feel it. I can't help it. I'm like that with myself. I'm like that in sports. And there was no time for nostalgia in that second half. There was no time. This dude was shooting every time he got the ball. His teammates were feeding him. He had no choice but to keep shooting. He was absolutely exhausted.
He was tired. That's one of the things I remember, and we talked about it in the moment, as you and I are looking at him in the beginning of the fourth quarter and saying, like, look at him, because we know his body language so well by now, and especially I don't know what the cameras caught versus what you could see when you're in the room. Yeah. He was exhausted.
Yeah.
And yet it's Kobe, so he's keeping pushing.
It is the most Kobe thing ever that he took 50 shots, you guys.
Of course, he
never took 50 shots in an NBA game, except for his last one.
So
that's freaking crazy.
I texted a bunch of players. The players are all still reeling about this. They're going to share their memories. You know, so many of the great Kobe stories have already been told, and they're going to share their memories at shootarounds and practices. But I did get in touch with Kyle Korver, who told me about that game.
Yeah.
So that was the last game of the season. And on the last day of the season, everybody plays. And a lot of the games tip at the same time for playoff race purposes. Mm-hmm. And so, but the
Warriors were going for 73. Remember that?
Yes, it was the same night. That's
I did. And I have to say that there was a big division at ESPN, and I'm sure with a lot of media outlets, on who was going to go to what.
And ESPN or ESPN2.
There was definitely the heavy favorite of going to see the Warriors make this history and get their 73rd win. And it's what ESPN chose to put on the main channel. And Kobe's game was on ESPN2, if I'm remembering all of that correctly. And for us, Ramona, we were kind of considered on the B squad, right? To go see. We both were like, no, we're going to Kobe. There was no question for either one of us. And I remember getting people saying to me, and I'm sure, you don't want to be, I mean, this is 73, Rachel, no one's going to ever do this again, 73. And I remember saying, there will never be another Kobe Bryant.
Yeah.
And I'm going to watch the Warriors next week in the playoffs.
I don't even remember who they played.
The Warriors?
Yeah.
They played Memphis. I know that because Matt Barnes said it on the show today.
Rach, do you know who was pissed about that?
Mm.
Kobe Bean Bryant.
Oh, about being on ESPN2.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, oh yes.
Yeah. He knew he was on the
dude. Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute. You think he wouldn't know?
No, I'm not.
You think that as he was getting ready for the pinnacle, the end of his career, his last NBA game, hosting family, dealing with teammates, it would have also not come under his purview as the 672nd detail of the day that he was on ESPN 2? Because trust me, he had time for 680.
So I talked to Kyle Korver, and he said, we were flying back from Washington, where we played the Wizards on the East Coast time slot to Atlanta. And only one guy's phone was picking up any Wi-Fi, and it was Dennis Schroeder. And these are the Mike Budenholzer Hawks, right?
Right.
Pass and unselfish. Like, they stand for everything that is, like, not the way Kobe was playing in that game or at that time. And Korver was like, and I talked to Horford a little bit about it, he's like, all of us were huddled around Dennis Schroeder's phone. The Wi-Fi wasn't good enough to pick up the visuals of the game. It was just like play-by-play updates, like it was 1995 when you were refreshing Netscape over and over again. It's like, oh, it's 3-2.
Loading.
Oh, single to left field. And they would just see the point totals going up and up and up. And they were sitting there on plane being
my God.
50!
Right.
Yeah! 60! They were like, we were just sitting there on the plane all standing up together around Dennis Schroeder's stupid phone because he was the only one that was getting Wi-Fi, celebrating every point that was scored. I thought that was a fun story.
It's amazing.
Kobe, to your point, Ramona. I'm glad you brought up the media stuff because the Walt Disney, Harry Potter, what was it called? Granity, his university he created. People laughed at that.
Yeah.
And people laughed at the Muse Cage and the Puppet Snake.
Muse Cage.
And the Puppet Snake. Remember the Puppet Snake, Lil Mamba?
I mean, the Puppet Snake kind of deserves some smiles. Come on.
No, no, I laughed at it.
But let's not put the Puppet Snake into sainthood just because Kobe died.
Oh, no. I laughed at the Puppet Snake, but at the same time, Kobe had no interest in being a talking head on NBA Countdown.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
No interest at all. And I admired at least, like, this guy's going to take big swings. It was very Kobe-ish. Like, this is how he played basketball. He was going to go into the media, and he was going to take big, big swings. And some of them were going to be, like, grotesque, hilarious failures.
Yeah.
And, like, you know what? He's all right with that.
But he was going to commit. You know what I mean? Like, he committed to that role. He committed to, like, whatever he decided he was going to do. And, like, you go ahead and try to tell him that the snake was kind of silly, right?
I mean,
go ahead. You want to try that?
He wasn't afraid to make mistakes.
Yeah,
and that's what I'm saying.
I want to be careful about talking about this. You mentioned earlier, you can't tell the story about. I'm going to back up. Sorry, so things aren't conflated. There were things in his life that he deeply regretted later.
Yeah,
and I'm not just talking about one thing. I'm talking about three or four very big things. And what I watched Kobe do after each of those things was try to be better. He tried to be better about how he treated women, and we saw such an emphasis on him promoting not just the women's game of basketball, but women in general, giving women voices that they didn't have space to speak and be elevated to being important. We saw him after he made some unfortunate comments, homophobic slur, go out of his way to learn and be better. And be someone who could be a champion and a voice for good in that area. Jemele Hill wrote a beautiful piece today about his initial reaction to Trayvon Martin.
Yep.
And that after he did that, he took the time to actually critically think about how he had acted, not assume that he was right, and then act differently and learn differently and do more the next time one of those situations came around. And for me, Kobe Bryant was not a saint. He was not, to say he was not perfect doesn't cover it. It was just that he wasn't all good all the time. And we don't need for him to have been, we don't need to pretend he was, to talk about the way he lived his life, the hole he leaves, how much he'll be missed. And for me, how I reconcile some of the incidents in his life that wouldn't be the things I would want one of my friends or someone I covered to do. I look at what he did afterward, because to me, that is such a big part of what life is about. You did the thing, now what? And Kobe, afterward, of so many different big things, really strove to be better. So that's the really big, important stuff. And then if you want to then make the leap to something that is much more trivial, like the snake puppet, he was okay with having done something one way the first time, learning how to do it differently. To me, with that detail series, he found his storytelling voice in terms of basketball in such an incredible way, because he just sees things other people don't see. And the way he was breaking down the game in those tapes, to me, maybe you had to start with a puppet snake to get to that.
Yeah.
Well, Ramona alluded to this earlier, but 4 years ago, I woke up, 6 in the morning Eastern time. I had a text at 3 in the morning. From a number I didn't have, a 949 number I didn't have. Mm-hmm. And the text just said, "It's Kobe, call me."
Hmm.
And I was like, well, this is not a real thing. This is obviously, I'm being pranked. And I called Ramona. I said, so I got a text from this number. Here's the number. She said, no, that's Kobe. And then I thought, well, I haven't been very nice to Kobe in some of the things I've written and said about him on a podcast. Yeah. I've alluded to the fact that I think he might be a tick overrated in the historical player debate, and that he's playing, let's say, carnival-esque basketball in his later years. I wonder am I about to get yelled at? What's going on?
Yeah.
And so I called him, and what he really wanted to talk about was he thought that media coverage of basketball had gone off the rails. And he had seen stuff that I'd written that was breaking down X's and O's and all of that. And he said, you know, we need more of that and less of the noise and the drama. You know, this is probably 2 months before he's going to retire. So obviously he's thinking about his next venture. He's already thought about it. And he talked about how he wanted to not be a part of the NBA coverage machine, but to start his own NBA coverage mm-hmm. machine so he could cover the league the way he thought it would be covered. And he talked about on that day, he talked about how it was going to be like turning the Titanic around. That's what he called it.
Wow.
It was going to be turning the Titanic around. And so I said, I'm coming to LA in a couple weeks. No, I came to LA in May. He said, hey, do you want to come meet?
Mm-hmm.
Come watch Eastern Conference Finals Game 5, Toronto-Cleveland, with me in my conference room.
Hmm.
And I thought, well, this is going to be terrible.
Are you kidding?
Well, no, because I thought it's going to be a test. He's testing me and I'm going to fail because this is one of the 15 greatest players of all time and I'm a schmuck. I also was a little bit afraid because I know I was uncomfortable because I had never been in his orbit before.
Yeah.
And I know that I was uncomfortable with the allegations that had been made against him. I was uncomfortable. But I went. And I knocked on the door of his little second floor. You've probably been there, Ramona. Have you guys been there?
Actually, I never went down there.
It's like a little unassuming two-story building. Yeah. And I'm expecting 17 assistants with Bluetooth in their ears. And Kobe answers the door. He says, hey, nice to meet you. We go into his little conference room with a TV. And an assistant finally comes in, and the assistant has a six-pack of beer. And Kobe's like, you want to split this with me? And I was like,
all right.
I guess we're drinking beer and watching Eastern Conference Finals Game 5. And he proceeded to, like, break down the game for the next 2.5 hours and then talk about all the dreams he had for how he was going to change the way media was covered. He would stop it and be like, you see Kyle Lowry's feet? You see Kyle Lowry's feet? See how they're angled this way? Well, that guy with the ball should see that and drive this way. I'm like, man, I don't see – first of all, I'm 3 beers in. I'm a little buzzed.
Right.
So I'm not sure I see the whole thing. But it was one of those nights that was like an out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
And we stayed in touch all the time after that. We stayed in touch. Our last text, to everyone's point about how everyone has a Kobe story,
mm-hmm.
our last text was about Ben McLemore.
Wow.
Because I wrote a feature on Ben McLemore and his crazy journey in and out of the league and how deep into despair he got. And when he was out of the league last year, he was working out at Mamba Sports Academy.
Yeah.
And he saw Kobe. In like April, and Kobe was like, yo, what are you doing here? You're out of the league? Like, how is that possible?
Yeah.
Like, keep on working, keep on grinding. And to Ben McLemore, that was like, I'm going to keep going because Kobe said this to me. It was like a huge one to Kobe. I was like, do you remember that? And he was like, yeah, of course I remember that. Everyone has a Kobe story. Rachel, you have to go.
I do have to cut out. I'm going to put the little one tiny sprinkle on your story about Kobe and being in his little office and everything. The one framed magazine cover that Kobe Bryant had in that building, I don't know if you noticed it, was him and Gianna on the cover of Slam Magazine.
I didn't notice.
That's it. Mm. Think about all the covers he was on. Think about all the moments in his life he might want to put up on the wall and make a deal about. And that's what he wanted up, him and Gigi.
All right, Rach, go do your thing. I'll see you tomorrow. Momo, you've been an Angelino for a long time. You feel like you knew Kobe, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was weird. Like, I feel like we were friends, like especially towards the end. After it was way more so after he retired. But even while he was in it, like, you know, like we were. I'd be on the radio, and he would just start like emailing me whatever we were talking about. You could tell he was listening on probably the drive up from Orange County or something. He'd start going, and we'd talk after games, or he was just like, you know, like something would happen in the NBA, like Kevin Durant tore his Achilles. One of the first people I texted was Kobe. Like, you always just, like, reached out to him. I think because I knew him for so many decades, really the first, I think I knew number 24, not number 8. You know, number 8 came first, and that was the young man. I was in high school when he came into the league. I went off to college for a couple years. Those were, like, the 4 years I missed, but I followed it. And when I came back, he's still number 8. But he turned into a different person. He was 24. He was a grown up at that point. And, like, you know, he would always ask me about, like, my family. He would always, like, especially later on, like, I've told the story a couple of times and it's still kind of like surreal to me, but he would like check on me when I was pregnant. He'd be like, hey, how you doing, sis? How's mama doing? You know, like I was pregnant. Like, he knew and he knew what a big deal it was for me. And what I was going through. And like, he was, you know, he said like, keep me updated, right? He even asked me like, what hospital was I at? Send me the registry info. He didn't send anything, but like, it was just this, like the fact that he even cared, right? Like that, like what you said, you know, am I really in Kobe Bryant's office, like drinking a beer? Like what's happening here? And I remember Gotham Chopper, who did the documentary on him. Like, we used to talk all the time because I felt like Kobe let me and Gotham into his world and his who he was pretty deeply. And so Gotham and I would sort of commiserate about what that was like. Like, I think he said it was exhausting and exhilarating. And now that he's, you know, at the time, you know, Gotham wasn't working with him anymore. Gotham's gone on to do documentaries on Tom Brady and Steph Curry. He's working on another one now about another great player. He's like, man, I miss that guy. You know, he drove me crazy, but there's nobody like him. And so I feel like my job right now, like yesterday when this happened, I feel like it's my job to tell people about the man that I knew, the guy who let me see him, who talked about deepest, darkest, awful things, who talked about his fears and the way he saw the world. I mean, I pushed him pretty hard the last few months of his career because I challenged him on a lot of things. And it was like a game of one-on-one. Like, it was amazing. And I just think, I feel honestly like I don't know what to do personally. I think I'll go home and I'll hug my son and I'm going to feel the personal loss a lot more once I get done with the initial having to work and talk and share. But I also feel like it's kind of an honor that he let us know him. And I feel very strongly that that's what I should do.
What else should people know? Like, when you say you talked about darkest fears and this and that, like, what are conversations, if any, that stand out to you?
You know, I said, you know, what are your fears? We talked a lot about the hero's journey, right? Like, who are the threshold guardians? Who are the dragons that you had to slay? And he goes, to a certain extent, every day I was vulnerable. You're always dealing with fear, with something in your imagination, something that you think can happen. But you just say, I don't know if I can do that, but I'll give it a try. Like he wasn't fearless. He may seem like it, but he was just much better at compartmentalizing that, at dealing with it, at looking it in the eye. He told me to keep him updated on the pregnancy. Like, I told him, I think I sent a text like, all right, game on, you know, like when I was heading to the hospital. And, he checked on me later. Like, I think I got an emoji first and then he checked on me later and it was like 38 hours into the labor. And he just like knew what to say. Like, he just said, you know, you're about to have one of the greatest blessings that God can give. And not everybody gets to do that. And women make miracles. And, you know, if men were giving birth, like, we wouldn't have a civilization. And it was just like, and then I think I got a bunch of emojis with, like, you know, the strong flex bicep emojis or something. And it was like, I don't know. It was just the message was pretty simple. It was like, focus on the blessing, not the fear or the pain. I got it. And, you know, I had plenty of people there support me. I had plenty of friends and family, but I was like, wow, focus on the blessing. This fear of pain is just transitory. It's just ephemeral.
Why do you think he resonates? Why do you think every player who's 30 and under is a Kobe guy?
I think because he was one text away. And when he texted you back, or he wrote you, or he tweeted at you, or whatever it was. And Candace Parker told me this last night when we were talking about it. She goes, you kind of knew what he was going to say, but it was better when he said it. You know, it's like, it's almost like he had this like Yoda-like quality. Like, he'd lived through so many things. He'd challenge himself. He'd been through a lot of, you know, of everything. And he just kind of had this way of putting things and putting it in perspective, because he always tapped into the higher purpose, which is, you know, to pursue your own greatness, to fulfill your own highest self, which I think was what he was always going for. Rachel made a really eloquent point earlier when she said, you know, he made a lot of mistakes and he felt deep regret for them, and he should, but he tried to do better. He tried to be human. He even said about this, like, when I asked him about, you know, some of the bad parts of his life, he said, you have to understand the fact that we're human. We all say things that we shouldn't say. We all do things we shouldn't do. We are all angels and we are all devils. How are you going to understand that other than to understand the fact that we are all of those things? And it made me think about that famous quote, you know, do I contradict myself? Let me count the ways. you know, I am large, I contain multitudes. That was freaking Kobe, man. Like, he's all of that. The good, the bad, the ugly, the brilliant, the genius, the transcendent, the tragic. I mean, I think that's why we're feeling all of this right now, and why the this generation of NBA players, like Joel Embiid, literally called me and was like, please tell me this isn't true, Ramona. And I was standing outside the hillside where the plane was still smoldering. And he goes, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Kobe. He was a little boy in Cameroon. He'd never watched basketball before. And he saw Kobe in the 2008 finals and just saw the determination, the doggedness.
When they lost, by the way.
And they lost. But he saw that willpower, that Mamba mentality that we all talk about, and he just thought, I want to be that.
There's just something. Like,
yeah.
He became something. The discussion about him was not normal.
No.
And I don't, like, even the way we talk about LeBron,
mm-hmm.
it's about efficiency and stats and blah, blah, blah. It wasn't even about championship with Kobe. He transcended for some reason. I don't know if, I think it was a combination of he was a very stylish player, yeah. And he was the most fearless player. And people, like, you couldn't take your eyes off of Kobe, because even when he was doing ridiculous things, it came from a well and a reserve of fearlessness and crazy confidence that nobody else had. And, like, people just couldn't take their eyes off of it. And the discourse about him became, it's like an ideology. It's not about all the ways we discuss other players and other legends of the game. It reminded me a little bit of Allen Iverson in a different way, in that Iverson became something more, like, when you would get these discussions, like, Allen Iverson is not, he's inefficient, he's 40% career shooter, he doesn't translate, and like, in all those discussions, people, you're just missing the point.
Right.
You're missing the point. And Kobe became the same way. Well, he's only a 33% career 3-point shooter, and he took too many mid-rangers. For players and fans, it's missing the point. There's something larger and I don't know what the right word is. There's just something bigger than that about him for some reason. I don't know what it is.
I mean, he was the author of his own legend. He was the greatest storyteller the sports world has probably ever known. I mean, he thought about this stuff. He told me, he goes, I wrote 90% of my own commercials. Like, he worked on his slogans. Like, you know, there's, when you have a great advertising executive, they have a way of putting things. You know that one slogan he had, friends hang sometimes, banners hang forever?
Yeah, I do.
He was proud of that.
He trademarked it, I believe.
Yeah, he trademarked it. Like, there's a part of me that when I think about things like that, I laugh. There's a part of me that feels like it cheapens it, because it feels like he's monetizing it. But then there's another part of me that just, like, I shake my head because that was so Kobe. Like, he was so, like, he worked hard on that. He distilled down to its perfect essence, like, what that statement was. He was so on brand. He was so Kobe all the time. Like, to the point where, like, when I say he was so Kobe, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
When I say Mamba mentality, it's like, I can give you all sorts of
definitions. You want to roll your eyes a little bit.
You do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I kind of want to... Freaking guy.
Like when they made like when they made the Laker jerseys last year, 2 years ago, and I wrote about them and interviewed Kobe because they're mock snakeskin. I'm like, of course they're
it's
mock
too
skin.
Much. It was
of
always like on that, always skin. On that thing. It was a little too much.
But I just remember, I remember sitting down in 2013, I sat down with Dirk in Dallas and we were talking about his contemporaries and who he admired. And I didn't know Dirk well then, as well as I do now. He didn't strike me as a Kobe guy then, even though he's like a shot maker.
Yeah.
He's soft spoken. He's unassuming. You know, he looks the opposite of Kobe.
Yeah, you're right.
Loves Kobe. Huh. He's like, I would stay up till 1 a.m. watching Kobe. And I asked him, like, didn't he take a few too many crazy shots for you? Like, these crazy, like, it's a little selfish the way he plays. And Dirk would be like, it doesn't matter. Like, there's just something about it that I can't take my eyes off. And I said, well, what about Duncan? He said, I'm not comparing ranking. I'm just telling you, if you ask me who defines the NBA during my time in this league, it's Kobe Bryant. And I just thought he would say Tim Duncan or somebody like that. For him, it was Kobe. It was just something. He didn't want to hear the numbers. He didn't want to hear the, Tim Duncan was a great defense player. And he just said, I just gravitate toward Kobe. Just the combination of style and fearlessness. And something. I don't know what it was. Something.
that's why this next generation, they all grew up on him. Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, Kyrie Irving, Kevin Durant, they all grew up on Kobe. And we're going to, you know, you and I are writers. We're supposed to be good at this. We're supposed to be able to describe that something.
I in watching him last night in his prime, he was a very stylish player. And everyone compared the way he moved to Michael Jordan, right? And Michael Jordan, when he jogged back on defense, that was the coolest damn thing in the world.
Yeah.
Nobody jogged like Michael. He glided. He bounced and he glided. And you wanted to run like that with the gum chewing and all that.
Yeah.
And Kobe moved like that. But it reminded me watching him in this game against Utah. They would set these cross screens for him, and he would go from the left block, not even the left block, like across the paint, left to right, catch the ball on the move, turn and face in one motion and shoot with his legs kicking out, mm-hmm. right? These fadeaway catch and shoot long twos. And they did it over and over again because the Jazz couldn't do anything mm-hmm. about it. I thought of Roger Federer.
Yeah.
You know how Roger Federer just moves different?
Yeah.
There's just something, I don't know if whatever it is, it's like a liquidy gracefulness where there isn't like one movement leads to another. All the movements are linked in one continuous chain of liquidy motion.
Yeah.
That's how Kobe moved. And it was I think part of it was that he just looked cool. Like even his line drive jumper, which like you wouldn't teach someone to shoot with a line drive like that necessarily. It's one of the reasons he wasn't a great 3-point shooter. It just looked cool. It looked really cool.
I come back to that word audacity too. Like he played with audacity. Like, are you seriously taking that shot? That fall away, turn around, contested.
And sometimes the answer should have been like pass. A lot of times it should have been like pass. But that's just, you didn't get the great Kobe without that Kobe. They were the same.
Yeah. And it was just, there was, I want to say it was like, on the one hand, I feel weird saying it was so authentic. Because you and I both snicker when we think about him trademarking friends hang sometimes, banners hang forever. You know, the famous Mamba out, totally scripted.
Of course.
He had shirts saying Mamba out, ready to sell on the website the second the game was over. He was always going to say it. And yet, when he delivered the line, it felt absolutely authentic, didn't it?
I guess.
So I don't know. It's such a contradiction. But it felt that way. Like, you know what, like, you know, the kids would say, I don't know, he was a real one. Right? Like, I don't even know what that means, but it's a certain quality about Kobe that people connected to in a very authentic way. And I think it probably has to do with how much of himself he let us see. He was always guts on the floor. You know, I don't think he was, I know he was compartmentalizing and sublimating, you know, fears and doubts and, you know, whatever you want to say that everybody has, but you read it on his face. You felt his emotions, the rawness. Like, remember in 2008 in Boston, were you there for that?
I wasn't covering the NBA then.
So
I didn't start covering the NBA until the end of Kobe, to tail end of Kobe's career.
Okay.
10-11 was my first year. So I mean, I watched, but I was not there.
I was there for that, and just sat in the dark. Like, he's full uniform. He wouldn't even change out of his uniform. And it was just like this absolute, utter despair. And he sat in the dark in the showers, and there's that famous Ron Artest scene where he goes in there and says, I'll get you back next time. I'm gonna be there for you. We're going to win next time. But he goes and addresses the media afterwards, and you could tell he'd been crying, he was raw, and you could tell how much that meant to him. And it was like, I mean, it was so real. Like, as much as he did everything that was scripted, determined, thoughtful, born out, like, he always just kind of showed you what was in his guts and his heart and his soul. And I think it's really that authenticity that everybody connects to.
Yeah, he had a bad last three games of those finals. 6 of 19, 8 of 21, 7 of 22, and they kept him relatively off the foul line. If you look back at his series against Utah from two rounds before, here are his free throw attempts in game by game in the second round of the playoffs. 23, 12, 17, 10, 17, 17.
Wow.
That's insane. That's ridiculous. And people want to, sometimes it will end, I don't know how to end, but people want to skirt by those two championships in 09 and 10. as like, it was a weird kind of interregnum in the NBA. Yeah. Like LeBron's Cleveland teams weren't ready. He was about to go to Miami. Kevin Garnett got hurt, blah, blah. You can't do that. Like to even to everyone is hard. And like Stan Van Gundy and I were supposed to do a podcast. He was going to call the game on TNT tomorrow or we're taping this on Monday afternoon. And that he's not coming, but I mean, we were texting about that finals in 2010 between the Magic and the Lakers. And he was just like, man, he just kicked our There was just nothing we could do. And like that Magic team was really good.
Yeah.
And those Cleveland teams were really good. They never got to play in the finals. But don't, you can't skirt by those titles just because of those things. Every championship is hard to win.
Gary Vee, the Lakers trainer at the time, he always said of those two championships, like, that was an absolute miracle that they won. Like, those teams weren't that good. They weren't championship kind of teams. Kobe just willed them. Just absolutely willed them. And I'll never forget after he wins in 2009. You know, we're waiting for him to wax poetic, for him to say something big and grandiose. And, you know, Kobe likes some legendary kind of comment. And so the question comes in about, you know, what are you feeling? What was the first thing that you thought when you won this title? And he was like, that I got the same amount as Shaq now. I won without Shaq. Like, it was so petty. It was so great, though.
But that's the way it had to be.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you, you watch 2001 when they went 15-1 in the playoffs and just laid waste to everyone. Yeah. You watch that playoff run. It's hard to imagine two basketball players being better on the same team ever. Because that was – Shaq was always the top guy. He was the three-time finals MVP. He was the fulcrum. But that was as closer than Pippen ever got, closer than McHale ever got. Maybe Magic Kareem. I don't know. I'd have to go back and watch some 80s games. That was the slimmest gap between 1 and 1A. And their games complemented each other. And Kobe was just jumping out of the gym. And Shaq was like in relatively good shape for Shaq and just destroying people. And you watch that playoff run and you're like, I can't believe they ever lost a game. I can't believe they ever lost a game. And yet in 2000, it takes 7 games to beat Portland. Mm-hmm. In 2002, there's the infamous 7-game conference finals against the Kings. Two of those three titles hang by a thread. But that one playoff run, that's as dominant as any two players have ever been in the history of the NBA together. They swept the Kings. You know how many games the Kings won that year? 55.
Ooh.
In 2001. Swept like roadkill.
Yeah.
Just like get it, like we're done.
Yeah, I mean, just like Jordan, there's so many great teams and players whose careers are just footnoted as they kept losing to Michael, right? Like those great Utah Jazz teams, the Sonics teams. Like there's a lot of those, you know, those great Kings teams. They kept losing, right? The Portland teams, like they could have and probably should have been champions one of those years. They were good. But Kobe and Shaq were better. And, you know, looking, I actually feel, I've spent a day and a half really just talking about it, feeling, processing. I'm in a place now where, I'm really having a good time remembering all that. Like I'm remembering the man, the memories he left, the way he played. Cause I think, and we can all say this, Zach, do you think we'll ever cover a guy like this again? Do you think we'll meet a player like this again?
Well, it depends what you mean like this. We'll cover a player as great or greater.
Yeah.
We are right
now.
Yeah,
okay.
Someone who just captures the imagination of people this way, I don't know. I really don't know. We'll see. Probably yes, but I don't know. I don't know. Well, anyway, there's a Clippers-Lakers game tomorrow.
Maybe.
We'll see. And I don't really know how to go back to covering the league in the next few days, but we're all going to give it a shot, I guess. You know, and I don't know what we're going to do. We'll see if that game happens tomorrow, and if it does, I suspect it will be more of a tribute than a game.
Yeah.
But Ramona, you posted a story today on ESPN.com. It's probably leading the site right now. It's not going to be hard to find. And after he retired, you wrote a wonderful long feature, which I reread yesterday on the flight out here about, you know, the death of his NBA career and how he was reckoning with that. Please go read both of those and go back and hug your son, Ramona.
That's where I'm going right now.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.